session number 17117, reel 4.
Mr. Coco, reel 4.
And then that feeling of elation, somewhat selfish, but then turns to a degree of, oh dear, how many others are as lucky as I am? And I can remember making my way forward then from the express and looking at who was being picked out of the water. And I came across then some colleagues who'd been picked up. I remember going further, even right up to the forecastle. And I in fact met then an ERA, that's an engine room artificer, of the express, who in fact was an apprentice in a class 1 year senior to me in Chatham. And of course that gave me a certain fillip, I suppose, whereupon he said, oh, come on down to our mess, etc. And I went down there and, you know, make yourself at home, that sort of thing. I didn't stay down there too long because I suppose it could be said that though I was not first aboard the express, I was one of the first. And I went back up on deck again, and by that time the express had moved back into the main body of the survivors in the water. And when I made my way aft, and in fact to the very point when I went back right after the quarter deck, where in fact I'd been picked up, by this time now they had wounded laid out in the on the quarter deck by the after gun, and the sick bay people were tending to them as best they could, but we had people with burns from the explosions aboard the Prince of Wales. And of course this again made one realise how lucky one was, because I mean these people were they were in dire straits, and the burns were such that from you had the occasional almost scream coming from them. And to ease their burns, they were pouring lubricating oil over them to keep the air out of the burns. But some of those who were badly burned, of course, would not survive, and they would die before we arrived at Singapore. I then made my forehead, and an odd thing happened, in so much as that I bumped into the postman of the Prince of Wales. And after the Bismarck affair, we had decided to get married, rather on a better to have loved and lost, as it were. And and the wallet which I had had in my mouth, which had when I went over the side of the Prince of Wales, and which due to being a blow in the back with all the others on top of me as I went into the water, and which of course had involuntarily came out of my mouth and I'd lost it, the postman had picked it up. And what had happened, this wallet had floated to the surface, and he, being in a Carley raft, you know what those things are, with about umpty people hanging on it, and they were just paddling along, and you know the usual thing, covered in oil, had seen this. And of course you get, as I said to you earlier, with all the breaking of bulkheads and the junk and all that sort of thing surrounding a sinking, looked, and there's a wallet. And he picked this wallet up, and he brushed it off, the oil off it, and he looked inside it, and there, lo and behold, inside was a photograph of me when I was married. And he then said to me, "Here you are, I've got your wallet for you." And he gave me my wallet. And that, quite honestly, I was something quite memorable, this. That here I am, I'm survived a sinking. The sinking, the importance of which I was not to know until much later, and none of us was not to know that until, of course, history showed that, but we'll go into that later on. But here I am, I'm survived this great event, as it were, and I've also been presented with my wallet, which contained many things, of course, which are of sentimental value, and I couldn't replace. There wasn't a lot of money in it, a few Singapore dollars, but there was. Postie gave it back to me. And I can remember taking this down to the ERA's mess, down to where I'd gone before, and here getting a bit of cotton waste and going all over the photographs and taking the oil off them and saying, "Oh gosh, life is going to continue as before." But sorry to say, when we got into Singapore, I put my wallet under a pillow in the FSA, and it was pinched during the night. And I don't know who nicked that, but some, I think, I dare I say, yes, would it be right for me to say a Malay? But anyway, there it was. It was gone the next morning. But anyway, the postie gave me my wallet, and I thought, well, there it is. Well, I never did. But I was very pleased to see a number of my colleagues had managed to survive. One or two hadn't been picked up. We didn't know, of course, whether they had in fact been picked up by the express. But, of course, you have these people who are chums and shore-going and that sort of thing. And this is where you get a meeting up and, you know. And, in fact, we did have one sad situation where two were very, very close together, and you know, one survived and one didn't, and we had the trauma of that. But anyway, there it was, and we had a very big shipload, so large a shipload in fact that at one time the first lieutenant of the express had to come down from the bridge and ask us to try to trim the ship by being equally in number, or fairly equal in number, on each side of the ship. So the express really did its stuff. They did a great job, there's no doubt about that. And we then just steamed and back to Singapore, and the fears that the Japanese might attack us receded, and we felt, oh no, they've done their job, and they're not going to interfere anymore with us. And that, I understand, was in fact the case. And it's quite surprising that the Japanese pilots had been given instructions to sink the two capital ships, but they had not been given instructions to wipe out the little force, as it were. And since being back to the reunion of Prince of Wales and Repulse survivors, we have had one of our survivors who, through way of business after he left the Navy, has spoken to a Japanese in Tokyo, and the Japanese has told him that the Japanese followed orders expressly, right to the very letter of the law, as it were, the letter of the order given, to the extent that if they were told to sink the Prince of Wales and Repulse, they would do just that, and they would leave the destroyers alone, which of course is something surprising in our Navy, because if our flyers had been over there, they would have attempted to sink destroyers, everything. Anyway, we were very fortunate. We got back to Singapore to find that on the dockside, I had their other friends with whom I'd been an apprentice. They were in the Exeter, which had arrived in Singapore, and in the Mauritius. And one of them, unfortunately, in the Exeter, was sunk at the Battle of the Java Sea, and was taken prisoner of war. The one in the Mauritius, he in fact, they had boiler trouble in the Mauritius, and they came back to UK, and he subsequently became a foreign captain. So such are the fortunes of war, you know, just happens if you you know where you are.
Did the authorities make use of you in Singapore?
Yes, they. Now that's a very good question, because here, when we were given rum, more rum in Singapore, we were taken and to this particular block and building, which seemed palatial by our standards, and it was a big dormitory really, and we slept and we had a jolly good sleep, and they didn't wake us up early, and as I said, that's where my wallet was stolen. But it wasn't until about midday next day where you start to surface, and the bugle started to blow, and it was a clear lower deck of all Prince of Wales and Repulse. And I can remember the parade ground was covered in kind of gravel, and as we cleared lower deck and we gathered on to go onto the parade ground, there was a lieutenant commander there who had been out in Singapore the whole of the time up to then and not experienced any war. But I can remember him saying, come on, double up, clear lower deck as an evolution here. And I can remember that absolutely, that's absolutely true. And of course we are trying to pick our way across this gravel with bare feet, and we were hobbling across this gravel with bare feet, and this chap's telling us, come on, double up here and run, because clear lower deck's an evolution. And you can imagine the kind of reception he got. It was a bit of a raspberry, I'm afraid. But anyway, we were addressed then by Captain Bell, and we were told that, of course, the Japanese now were the enemy to be resisted. We all knew that. And the Marines were the first, in fact, to be kitted out. And they were kitted out, and they, poor banders, were promptly marched off up into the jungle, then to join up with the army, and the Marines then fulfilled their army role, if you like, and I'm afraid not many of them survived from that. For us who were left, we were dispersed then amongst ships to make up the ship's companies around as required, and I went down to the destroyer Isis, and I was sent down to the Isis, which was in dry dock. The Isis had been hit with a near miss in the Eastern Mediterranean, believe it or not, and there was no dockyard that could in fact repair her in Alexandria, because this is one must remember, a particularly bad time of the war for Britain. And she was here, she went all the way out to Singapore, and it was there that she was being repaired. She had no guns on her and no engines in the thing. She was in a very, you know, undergoing a major refit, if you like. And with her, of course, was the submarine called the submarine Rover. And it was aboard the Isis that I met the father of a great friend of mine who was an apprentice with me, and he was aboard the ship as well. Anyway, I was only on that ship for about 3 days, and I was then sent back to the Fleet Shore establishment whence I came with the rest of the survivors. And there I looked at the notice board, and I was very pleased to see that my name was included in a draft. Oh, I forgot to mention something very important on this. Before this, we had had a meeting. The ordnance lieutenant who had survived had gathered his staff around him, and I remember going to his cabin with four of my contemporaries who had left the ship. And he said, well, some are going to have to stay, he said, but most are going to go home. And he drew out a pack of cards, and we drew for who was going to stay. He said, but those who are going to stay will have a strong chance, nevertheless, of getting back, because, of course, being of the technical branch, we were particularly wanted in UK. Anyway, I, who was never lucky in any cards I've played. I must say that I didn't pick a particularly high card here. It was a 10 of clubs, but even that was sufficient to get me in and away. So that when I came back from the ISIS, back into... I didn't know, by the way, that that was the case, that, you know, that was enough to get me away. But when I came back from the ISIS and saw on the notice board, I knew that that was so. And I was then on a draft to leave Singapore on the steamship called Erin Pura. And this was an old British Indies steamship which picked up pilgrims from Singapore, Muslims, and took them to Mecca. It was no troop ship in any sense of the word. There were about 900 of us, if I recollect, in this particular draft, who went down to the Erin Pura. I can remember going back down to the quarters we were allocated, and it was just a hold, and a part of the hold is where they stowed the rubber, and it stunk like the devil. And there, of course, were great big flying beetles around the place in this hold, and rats, and well, quite frankly, it was not very good accommodation. But the fact must remain that we were leaving Singapore and we weren't going to grumble too much about it. And I can remember we decided to sleep on the upper deck, and we just slept on the deck, and that was it, because I had still no kit. I had been given a pair of grey flannel trousers by a sub-lieutenant aboard the Express, and I had my white shirt in which I'd been picked up. So I had a white shirt, no underpants. Yes, and I'd fortunately been given a pair of grey flannel trousers by a sub-lieutenant in the Express. And this, of course, was really what most of us were wearing. We had what we could have picked up or scavenged, if you like. And in fact, there were three of us who joined together, three colleagues from the Prince of Wales, three OAs, and we had a pillowcase, which in fact we'd nicked from the Fleet Shore establishment in Singapore, and we had in that a shaving stick, a shaving brush, and a razor, and we shared that, and that was our sole possession in that. And in the Erin Pura, as I said, we slept on the upper deck. And so we continued on this journey in the ship, which steamed along at about just over 5 knots, with a perpetual list of about 5 or 10 degrees to starboard. We wended our way down through the Indies, and in many ways that's the East Indian, Java, and down through Sumatra, down through the Timor Strait, this sort of thing. And in many ways it was a jolly good cruise, in so much we had nothing to do. We just lounged around on the upper deck, and we were crowded. We were almost like a one of the refugee ships, if you like. On the upper deck, we had an Indian doctor and his, I don't know if it was his wife or his assistant, but this lady stood at his side with a bright sari, and they had a table on which they had various jars in which worms and all sorts of things in suspended in you know, herbal aids. And this was the ship's doctor. And as I said, the sun was shining and it was like a cruise, and the only little blot on it was the fact that we ran out of water very, very quickly. And the water would come on at 4 o'clock in the morning and go off at about 4:15 in the morning. And we carried sheep and goats in the stern, alive sheep and goats. The crew were Lascar crew, and at dawn each morning they would go back and kill a goat or a sheep, and that would be cut up, and that would be the meal for the day. And we had for to our galley were two rather great big two big coppers, rather like the coppers in which I can remember when I was a small boy my mother did her washing, and this is back now to about 1925-1926. She used to prod the washing down with a great big washing stick, and I used to help her with a roller in the mangle. But these two coppers were somewhat similar to that, and the cooks we had, survivors who were officially trade-wise, if you like, cooks, they used to make the tea in the morning in the coppers, because the tea would be just merely contaminated, in brackets that of course, but not quite, but the residual tea leaves would be not too bad to leave behind in the copper compared with fatty bits of goat. So the tea was made first, which we used to drink, and then in one copper would go the rice to be boiled, and in the other would either go the goat's meat or the sheep. And this of course is what we lasted on. The bread, we had no bread at all, and that's how we went. But of course, by and large, we were quite happy. It was warm, it was sunny, the sea was calm, and we were making our way steadily towards Colombo. I can remember one specific instance. We had a petty officer, and may I quote a name, called Uren, U-R-E-N. It's a good West Country name from Plymouth. And he contracted toothache aboard there, and it was very bad. And his jaw swelled up quite terribly, and he was in a great deal of pain. And we had no dentist aboard. And there were only about two dozen first-class passengers on there, one of whom was a doctor from the Repulse. And he said, well, okay then, if you don't, I'll do it for you, if you don't mind. He said, the fact I'm not a dentist. But they went to the engine room, they got a pair of pliers, and one thing they did produce for Uren was some rum, which we'd not seen. And they gave him rum, and everyone chipped around and gave him sippers, and they made him a bit drunk. And this chappie, this doctor from the Repulse, pulled out this damn great molar with a pair of pliers without any aesthetic, anything at all. And I can remember that was blood everywhere. Another memorable incident on that was, of course, we came up for Christmas, and one of the lady first-class passengers came to the barrier. And of course, one must bear in mind, we're talking now in the time when first and second class passengers were clearly segregated, and they were segregated in no mean manner by quite a gate across the sections on the boat deck. And she came to ask the lads to sing carols for Christmas. I don't think she had a great deal of response, because people were beginning to tumble to the fact that they had tons of bread in the first class, and they were living the life of Riley. And that was only too apparent as we approached Colombo, because this stale bread, as it became, was being thrown over the side. And we could, I can never forget this, we're seeing the, in the wake of this Erin Pura, this 5-knot, 8-knot wake, the loaves of bread bobbing in the wake. And there had been bread aboard the ship, which we'd certainly not seen any. When we arrived in Colombo, we tied up outside in the harbour, that is. We didn't go alongside any jetty at all, but I don't think many ships do. But we tied up to buoys, and they then told us that we were staying there until we were drafted off to other ships. By this time, being on goat's meat and rice, I'm afraid we were all, and that was the one meal, by the way, in a day, we were all feeling rather hungry. And there was very near a mutiny on the ship then, because a lieutenant commander on the ship, who was the head of the draft, as it were, he was one of those who had come out of Singapore, and he had in fact taken a relief from the Prince of Wales, a lieutenant commander called Terry, who had in fact been involved in Norway before we'd got out to before he came to the Prince of Wales. He'd been sunk in the Prince of Wales, and when of course he got to Singapore after being a survivor, this chap who had been out living the life of Riley picked Terry as his relief, and he came out of Singapore with all his kit and all his trunks and everything, you see. And this chap gathered us all in the well deck of the Arampura to tell us that we were all going to stay aboard the Arampura, etc., until we were dealt with. This didn't go down too well, and in fact it caused so much dissension, and indeed it almost reached a mutinous kind of condition, and they hurriedly went ashore, and a paymaster came back with a tray of cash, and we were all given a one-off payment of how many rupees, I can't quite remember. But I can remember going ashore into the Bristol Hotel and having a mixed grill, and then going to a sergeant's mess and having tons of beer, and coming back to the Bristol Hotel and having more mixed grill, and then wandering back aboard the Arampura. But we were certainly hungry, and we were certainly resentful of the fact that these people who had all their kit, all their uniform, and they were telling us in fact what to do. This indeed, when I have read the book Battleship about the Admiral, this came down from the Admiral Leighton, who was Commander-in-Chief at that time in the Far East, who in fact had been on his way back home, but when Phillips had gone down with the Prince of Wales, had been summoned by the Admiralty to take control of the situation, he had said himself that the survivors were to be dispersed amongst the Far East, and there would be no mention of the word survivors, there had to be a war to be fought, etc. and so on. And again, as I've said to you about the unhappiness of the ship, this did not go down too well at all. Anyway, I was one of the fortunate ones, and when we gathered after having our big eats ashore on the following morning, I went to the Empress of Russia, which was a Canadian Pacific boat in anchored on the buoy opposite us in Colombo Harbour. We had looked at that with envy and wondered what it would be like aboard there, but I was one of the almost few, being a technical type, who was drafted aboard the Canadian Pacific ship to come back to UK. But I did leave behind a number of people who went to various cruisers and destroyers, and they had to continue to fight the war out in the Far East. For my part, I'll never forget stepping down into that lighter in Colombo, and a lighter in Colombo at that time was quite something to see, because they were the things towed by tugs. They used to pile lots of people into it. They used to draw the coolie labour out to coal ship. And when one thinks in times of the British Raj, and you see how they coaled ships and drew these lighters alongside, and these chappies carried great hundredweight bags of coal aboard ship, is quite something to be seen. And of course, those days have long gone. But anyway, it was in such a lighter that we were taken to the Empress of Russia, and I remember going up the great steep side of the gangway of the Empress of Russia, being greeted on deck, because we'd obviously our arrival had been expected, and we were taken down then to a dining room in which, quite frankly, it was almost like going into fairyland. There was clean tablecloths. There were tables were set with all the knives,